Case number 08-7121. Henry Montgomery Blair Sibley responded. Mr. Sibley for the respondent, Mr. Netter for the amicus curiae.
If it please the court.
Morning, counsel.
Good morning, your honors. I have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you for this opportunity to address you this morning. I believe you should enter an order with your names on it, suspending me from the practice of law before this court. I believe you should enter that order after you discharge your obligations under Marbury versus Madison to say what the law is. For in this case, as you well know, the law is you may not suspend me from this court without making the finding that I was afforded due process of law in Florida. So your order must say, we suspend Montgomery Blair Sibley from practice of law in this court because we find the Florida disciplinary proceedings afforded him due process of law, notwithstanding that he was accused not under oath. He was accused by individuals who are absolutely immune from making accusations based on malice, bad faith, or indeed even corrupt motives. He was afforded due process of law, even though he was accused not under oath and by individuals motivated perhaps by those causes, and then denied the opportunity to cross-examine those individuals under oath.
What's the source of your proposition that there has to be an accusation under oath in order for us to conclude that there was due process of law, or even that we're supposed to look that far behind the decision of the court as to which we are extending reciprocal discipline?
My brief cites you ex parte Burr, an 1821 Supreme Court case, Your Honor, that explicitly says these allegations must be under oath.
What was Burr concerned with?
It was concerned with Aaron Burr, who was suspended by the Supreme Court of the United States at that point in time. And he, in fact, wasn't accused under oath, and that became an issue, although it was later resolved because Mr. Burr, in fact, brought the suspension issue to the court and then went on to resolve it. But it was very clear that the court said, if it's not under oath, we're not even going to go there.
In the circumstance of Burr.
But in the circumstance of Burr.
This is a reciprocal discipline matter in which we're looking at the discipline imposed by another state.
Correct.
And you have not given me anything closer on point than Burr as to that we're supposed to look behind the reciprocal discipline to the point of how the accusation was made in determining whether there was fundamental due process. Is that the best you've got on that, Mr. Sibley?
It's not only the best, Your Honor, it's dispositive. You cannot suspend me here if you are not satisfied that I was afforded procedural due process.
We're with you 100%, sir.
Good. So is it procedural due process?
Now we get to that point then.
Good.
And I'm asking you where your authority is that to determine whether this meant fundamental due process, we have to look behind the discipline as to which we're affording reciprocity to determine the precise nature of how the accusation was made?
Not only the accusation, but the entire process from beginning to end. But discard, if you will, the fact that I was not accused under oath.
Even cases, Supreme Court cases, that say that defective indictments where the grand jury, where the defect is in the composition of the grand jury, are not examined behind it, where you the probable cause finding is not examined because there has been further proceedings that have determined the merits.
Well,
so why should we go further than the Supreme Court does with a regularity of indictment.
Then forget the sworn allegation, Your Honor. Let's move on to the fact that I was not allowed to confront those accusers. Assume that they can accuse me and be motivated by malice, bad faith, or corrupt motives.
You mean,
am I not allowed to cross-examine them on those motives to test the validity of their accusations?
Is that your argument that they didn't continue the hearing?
That's a separate argument. That's an abuse of process argument that, in fact, after waiting 8 years for my hearing, and because I had professional conflicts, in fact, in this circuit involving cases this court may or may not be aware of, I simply requested a 2-week adjournment, which wasn't afforded to me. However, it had become a kangaroo court at that point because orders had already been entered, denying me the opportunity not only to cross-examine witnesses, denying me the opportunity to call witnesses, denying me the opportunity to raise constitutional objections to the very proceedings, for they were indeed stricken from consideration. They weren't determined and denied for some basis that was articulated on the record. They were simply stricken from the record completely. Yes, the fact that it wasn't adjourned 14 days, I think, speaks to a question of whether due process was afforded here.
But wait, you knew of the hearing, right?
You had
notice of the
10
hearing.
10 days before the hearing, I got notice of an out-of-state hearing.
And you asked for an extension.
I asked for a 2-week extension.
So you're suggesting to us that the denial of a motion to extend a hearing creates a due process problem? That
Judge Tittell, if I were standing here on that point alone, I would simply have a hard time keeping that argument. However, you can't ignore the totality of circumstances here and what was in fact a judicial lynching down there.
I'm sorry. Well, could you just go back to my question? Which is that it's your theory that the denial of a motion for extension of time, postponement of a hearing, presents a constitutional due process issue that this court can recognize? Not standing alone. Okay. Well, combined with what else?
Combined with the fact that this quasi-criminal proceeding, I was denied the opportunity to cross-examine my accusers. I was denied the opportunity to call witnesses in my defense. When I raised the issue that Florida State was punishing me for being a federal litigant and resorting to federal court, they violated Donovan versus Dallas.
The witness you wanted to call was the judge, right?
No, it was not, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, it wasn't?
No, it was not. I noticed the deposition, or I requested a subpoena for the deposition of Joanne Sargent, the counsel for the Third District Court of Appeal of Florida. She had written a letter on behalf of the entire 12 judges of that District Court of Appeal stating, we believe Mr. Sibley should not be allowed to teach a course in Florida entitled How to Sue Judges Personally. That was an indication of a entire bias by that court.
What does that whole subject have to do? You were not disbarred for teaching that course, were you?
In my mind, Your Honor, absolutely.
Let's go back to what happened. You were disbarred being in contempt of court for not paying your child support, right?
That is exactly right,
right.
Your Honor.
Okay.
But you asked me what happened.
You were not disbarred for teaching that silly course, right?
Well, except what record do you have in front of me? I couldn't cross-examine all those people on why they entered that order on child support. I couldn't call witnesses to refute the bias.
And you paid the child support?
Your Honor, the child support was paid many, many years ago. It was paid before this incident even got to the complaint stage.
For not paying the child support, and you went to jail, right?
I did 78 days, Your Honor, in the Miami-Dade County Jail.
I'll take that as a yes.
Take that as a yes to what, Your Honor?
My question that you were held in contempt and you went to jail for not paying your child support.
And then what did the appellate court say to the trial court judge who entered that order and incarcerated me 60 days before I was?
They said affirmed, didn't they?
They did, Your Honor. But how did they say affirmed? Did they not say it was the right result for the wrong reason? And if it was the wrong reason, Your Honor, then is that wrong reason not immediate to your question here about whether I violated an order? Was I able to pay the child support I was put in jail for? Or did the appellate court say he couldn't pay the child support? His father could pay the child support. We have a completely new theory of law.
That's not the question that Chief Judge Santel asked you. The question was, let me ask it this way, okay? When you left the state of Florida, did you know you would trigger a child support payment obligation under your divorce settlement?
No, I didn't. I believed in 2000 I had a court order.
Isn't that in the divorce settlement?
Your Honor, it is, but there was an amendment to that divorce settlement, which was approved by in writing by the court, saying I may leave the state of Florida with my children, which I did on notice per the court order in July of 2000. Their mother refused to return those children to me, and it was 2.5 years later before they resolved who should have custody. At the end of 2.5 years, the judge retroactively applied child support of $4,000 a month, and then said you have 90 days to pay $175,000 because you have the ability to pay it. She was reversed on appeal. Now, they left me in jail for 78 days while I got around to deciding that.
Reversed?
She was reversed on appeal on the finding that I had the ability to pay that money.
Reversed, they found error on one. They did not reverse her judgment, right?
They affirmed for the wrong, the right result for the wrong reason. But if the reason is that I'm not in contempt of court because I didn't pay child support, but my father should have paid my child support, that doesn't mean I was in contempt of the order. It means my father was in contempt of the order.
Still on the books that you were convicted.
Yeah, Your Honor, I am on the books for that. And why haven't I had the chance to cross-examine those accusers? Why wasn't these constitutional impediments to even prosecuting this case allowed to be heard? Is because I represent jail for judges in Florida that I try to incarcerate judges for behaving on the bench in that manner?
Your time is up. Unless my colleagues have questions, we will hear from the amicus.
May it please the court. This proceeding is not an opportunity for Mr. Sibley to relitigate past defeats. Principles of collateral estoppel apply in attorney disciplinary proceedings, and unless Mr. Sibley can demonstrate that he was deprived of notice or the opportunity to be heard in the Florida proceedings, a reciprocal sanction must be entered.
Can you help me understand what the language in Ex parte Burr is talking about?
Well, sure, and I think that Chief Judge Sentell was gesturing toward the unique factual circumstance of that case. This was a disciplinary proceeding against Aaron Burr. But instead of a charge being filed against Aaron Burr, Mr. Burr came to the court himself and asked for the court to begin proceedings against him. So the court was merely describing that ordinarily, in the typical case, someone comes and files charges, but this is not the usual case. It was descriptive of the quirk in the Burr case, but in no sense does it create some special requirement. And indeed, Mr. Sibley does not deny that he had notice of these proceedings. He had notice of the precise charges. And it's unclear what exactly a sworn instrument would have provided, especially in a circumstance such as this one, where the premise of the misconduct proceedings were signed judicial opinions.
I'm troubled by the fact that the referee's report is verbatim for the Florida Bar's report. Can you address my concern on that? Why it doesn't look like some separate inquiry was taken?
I think there are a couple answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, the content of the report is merely saying this is what the Florida Circuit Court held and holding Mr. Sibley in contempt, and this is what the Florida Third District Court of Appeal held. There were no independent facts that were found by the judge, and indeed, under any circumstance, the judge would be bound by res judicata, as Mr. Sibley had the full opportunity to litigate those matters through the Florida courts.
Is there anything
courts
in the referee's support that suggests that the referee conducted some sort of review and didn't just cut and paste what had been done before?
Well, certainly he changed the sanction. In the view of the referee, the 2-year sanction that was recommended by the Florida Bar was insufficient. He changed that sanction to 3 years. Now, in reciting the facts of what the Florida courts had previously done, it's true that the referee copied what had been done verbatim. But in the case here, in which Mr. Sibley,
more than that, didn't he copy more than just the findings of facts? Didn't he also adopt the proposals as well?
Well, he did not adopt the proposed sanction. The referee expanded the sanction from 2 years to 3 years, and that certainly reflects independent judgment. He did recite the same facts as to how the previous Florida courts had issued rulings contrary to Mr. Sibley's interests. I would add also that Mr. Sibley made much in his presentation today about his inability to confront his accusers. This circuit has a clear precedent on the question of who constitute accusers. The case of Thomas versus Baker, which we cite in our brief, is a case in which a litigant tried to seek the depositions of members of a State Department Administrative Review Panel. And this court said that a deliberative body, when it makes a decision, those are not accusations. There is precedent not just from this court, but across the country, of course, that judges speak through their opinions, and it's not proper to seek depositions of those judges to find out how they were thinking or what motivated the facts that were indeed found. The appropriate recourse, if there were errors of fact in those opinions, would be to seek judicial review.
Let me ask you a question about what you think our role is here. I mean, you're certainly right that this isn't a collateral attack on the Florida proceedings. That's not what we're doing. And I think you also said that we're pretty much limited to here to exploring whether there was notice and opportunity for hearing, right?
That's correct.
That's pretty much it. So your run-of-the-mill disciplinary case involves a hearing. The lawyer obviously knows about it. There's an appeal, and sometimes all the way to the Supreme Court of the state, as there was here. Is that all we do? I mean, what else do we look for? Is that it? I mean, if they had a hearing that he knew of, is that the end of our analysis?
In most circumstances, it is. But there are some unique circumstances in which, for example...
Yeah, give me an example of a situation where we might go beyond that.
Well, one example is the Ruffalo case, which is a Supreme Court case we discuss in our brief, which is a local Ohio jurisdiction imposed a sanction against a lawyer for hiring a private investigator to do some digging up research against his own company.
Right.
And the Ohio bar and the Ohio court believed that this reflected unethical conduct. When the district court in Ohio pursued disciplinary sanctions against that petitioner, or that respondent, excuse me, it determined that that was not conduct.
Yeah, but that's not this case. I mean,
no, absolutely.
Right. I mean, but in a case where there's not a debate about whether the conduct is sanctionable and where there is a hearing, is there anything left for us to do?
In our opinion, no, there's not. The principles of res judicata, once he has had an opportunity to litigate these principles, so long as the same law is being applied, that's all this court needs to do. It needs to confirm that there was an adequate procedure because a proceeding without due process.
You just said adequate procedure.
That's correct, which is notice and the opportunity to be heard.
Notice and opportunity to be heard.
And the opportunity to be heard would presumably encompass such rights as the opportunity to have an impartial tribunal deciding the issues.
Oh, it would. So I see. So if there was evidence that the tribunal was biased, we could look at that.
If there was evidence that would rise to the level of a due process violation, indeed, because if there is a violation of due process, then collateral estoppel would not apply. There'd be no res judicata effect on this court.
Well, take the bias issue. Suppose the lawyer litigated the bias issue in the proceeding. Suppose he moved to recuse the panel and lost and appealed. Then what? Do we have any role then?
Well, as a general matter, you would not, unless he was alleging a due process violation in the appeals.
Well, you're now, just labeling it. I mean, that doesn't help me. I mean, I don't understand that. If he litigates the bias issue and loses, and he claims they were in fact biased, would that be beyond our purview?
It would not be beyond the purview. If indeed the respondent could demonstrate that there was a constitutionally cognizable bias that had not been resolved by a court.
So it is a collateral attack. That's exactly what that would be.
It would be a collateral attack only if it could rise to a constitutional level, because there would be no judgment that this court could recognize if it had not been subject to due process. Now, another important factor here.
I thought the answer would have been, look, if the lawyer raised the bias issue and had an opportunity to have it heard and lost and appealed and lost again, what would be left for us to do? We certainly wouldn't take evidence on whether the evidence that the Florida courts heard was complete or not, would we?
No, you wouldn't. In fact, I was interpreting your question in a more abstract sense, which is if the respondent were arguing that even on appeal there were a bias that prevented him from getting his hearing on that issue. But certainly, if the issue was raised and adjudicated by a court of competent jurisdiction, then that would be the end of the matter.
And that's what I'm getting. So it's hard for me to see what our role is or why we even go through all this process here if the only question is whether or not, I mean, under your theory, all we would need to impose reciprocal discipline is a certification from the Florida courts that that they held a hearing at which the lawyer had notice. That's it.
That's correct. If the respondent wanted to challenge the fact that he had notice or the opportunity to be heard, and for example, if the respondent had not been present at the hearing because he had never been advised
of
the hearing, that's a separate issue.
That's easy. But I'm asking you, but that's hard. I mean, it's hard to imagine that they would, that any state would discipline a lawyer in absentia. But let's assume it does. Then that's your case. But I've never seen one like that. In every case I've seen, and we get a lot of these, they're all cases that look like this. Well, not exactly like this, but they are all procedurally similar to this. That is, there's a hearing, there's discipline, there's an appeal, and then it comes to us. And, you know, but what you're saying is that that's the end of our role, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And perhaps some historical context in terms of where this court's disciplinary rule comes from would be helpful, which is it's essentially a codification of the Supreme Court's rule in Selling versus Radford from the 19-teens, when there were much different flavors to the attorney discipline actions.
Suppose we thought that the state court was sanctioning only black lawyers, and there was evidence of that. Would we not look behind that at all?
To the extent that there were a constitutional due process issue that had...
Of course there is for that.
Well, exactly.
I mean, that's easy. But and suppose the issue had been litigated in the state courts. He raised it and lost.
Well, that...
And he had evidence here that that was just not accurate, and that by sanctioning him, we would be supporting the discriminatory sanctioning policies of the state court.
That may be the case. However, the Supreme Court has a role to play in reviewing those.
But he had notice and an opportunity for hearing in that case, and he lost. That's the end of our process.
That is. In fact, the full faith and credit statute would require this court to give full faith and credit to the decision of the Florida court, which the Supreme Court could obviously intervene and reverse. But even if this court believed that a decision had been wrongly made, so long as the ultimate decision by the ultimate decision maker did not constitute a violation of due process, this court does not have a role to relitigate those issues.
Well, your time is up, unless my colleagues have further questions. Did Mr. Sidley have any time left? We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Sidley. Thank you, counsel. You were asked by the court to serve as amicus, and the court thanks you for your service. Mr. Sidley.
Briefly, in that ex parte Burr, it said, quote, that the charges in a regular complaint against an attorney ought not to be received and acted on unless made under oath is admitted. My second point is this.
And you know, if we had an original proceeding here where we had accusers, that might be relevant. But where we're passing on decisions made by other tribunals, I don't see why it still has any relevance.
Well, maybe it doesn't, Your Honor. But I believe it does, because that's all part and parcel of a meaningful hearing. And that includes a meaningful accusation under oath. I would also like to point out that, indeed, the referee's report was copied verbatim from the proposed submitted report by the Florida Bar, with the singular exception of the time being changed from 2 years to 3 years.
I'm not sure why that's a problem.
The Supreme Court, and I believe this court as well, has spoken out about the process of trial court judges adopting verbatim proposed orders.
Yeah, and you quoted part of what they said in Bessemer City. But after they got through saying we're aware of the potential for overreaching and exaggeration on the part of attorneys preparing findings of fact when they already have been informed that the judge has decided in their favor, you stopped there in quoting. What it said next was, nonetheless, our previous discussions of the subject suggest that even when the trial judge adopts proposed findings verbatim, the findings are those of the court and may be reversed only if clearly erroneous. And in that very case that you cited, Judge McMillan had adopted the findings tendered by the Chambers firm verbatim. Fourth Circuit had said what you want people, judges to say, well, that's not the finding of the court, we'll reverse it. Supreme Court said, no, you won't. It's his findings once he adopts them, even if they're verbatim.
Am I mistaken, Your Honor?
Bessemer said it really doesn't stand at all for the proposition you're citing it for.
I may be mistaken, but I think the judge orally announced his decision and then invited proposed orders upon which he adopted. That didn't happen in this case. There was no oral adoption by the referee.
The opinion of the Supreme Court didn't turn on that, and the opinion of the Fourth Circuit didn't turn on that.
I will stand corrected.
He announced his decision and invited the submission of, as it happens, counsel, I was there.
Well, then you would know better than anyone in the room, okay. Your Honor. Again, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, counsel. Once again, we'll pause a moment while presumably some of the courtroom. I thought a lot of it would empty after the energy case, but I guess we've got replacements, so we'll see what happens next.